from tragedy to triumph. Hosted by Aaron Lane.
The public did not understand exactly what's going on. And this, right. Of course, one of the things we're out to clarify and rectify is that there's just so much misinformation, and John Q. public does not understand the many moving parts of the problem.
Yeah.
We should start because yeah, we're wasting gold nuggets.
I got
here.
You. And 3, 2, 1. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of Tragedy to Triumph. I'm your host, Aaron Lane, a man in long-term recovery who has dreams and aspirations of doing big things. Now, on a daily basis, we hear tragic stories in the news, people losing their lives to addiction, families displaced in the system. But our goal here is to present you with amazing success stories of people who have changed their lives and gone from tragedy to triumph. Now, my guest today, another phone interview, which is really exciting to me because I get a chance to talk to people all around the country, is a man by the name of Keith Keller. And Keith is not only an expert in recovery, but he's an author who has written this incredible book, The Infinite Recovery Handbook. And Keith, I mean, you know, what better way to have somebody introduce themselves than just allow you to take it away and help everybody what you're all about?
Hello, Aaron. Thank you. That was a really good introduction. Thank you so much for that. And let me say before we get going here that I am a huge fan and tremendously appreciate what you are doing with your podcast and your own personal story. And yeah, really, really excellent. So thank you for doing
that.
What you do.
No, likewise. I mean, I think what tends to happen is we gravitate towards the like-minded people, right? And while I have a very specific lane that I stay in with, just sharing stories of recovery, someone like yourself who has embodied and done the research in an area to help, one, get rid of stigma, change the narrative, tell people ultimately that, you know, this is a learnable skill, that recovery can be applied to anybody. And I'm really intrigued by that and the amount of work that you've done. So I think it's really cool. I mean, even if it was like by happenstance that I became familiar with you through a comment you made online. I was like, that's really wild. I had never considered that you can rebuild pathways in your brain and that, you know, this, you can learn this. And I mean, why don't you give kind of a breakdown of what, one, this book that you've written is all about, and your second book, by the way, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And thank you again. My work is done here. You just tied it up with a bow on top and, you know, basically summarized what I'm out here doing. So I have written in the last, published in the last year, my second book, which is a nuts and bolts how-to guide for anyone just entering recovery through establishing recovery and then on and upward to a kind of a high-end transformation, which has been my own experience. So I am in recovery long term, 28 years. I became a registered nurse and I started to question things outside the mainstream medical model and pursued education and training in alternative, complementary, holistic, and energy healing practices. And then finally, I, you know, sort of filtered that all through my recovery, the mainstream of healthcare. And then about 8 years ago, started studying and learning about the new science-based transformation techniques that are out there. So this, I kind of pull all these things together, and what I've come up with is a belief, an unshakable belief that recovery is a skill that can be learned by anybody, and if approached this way, in a sort of a more methodical step-by-step approach than the traditional model, the 12-step AA-NA, which has been around, which gets so many things right, yet it is a little bit old. It's getting a little bit mysterious to some people who,
right.
You know, the wording, the translation, the literature, and, you know, the approach. So, time to take another look. You know, we're not going to change what's there, but let's build on top of it. Let's take that as a foundation and look at the best of what's around now, what experts know, what scientists are learning, and bundle this all together and see if we can, you know, make a difference.
And modern, well, I think the important thing, I mean, which you hit on, is the modernization of it, right? So we've modernized recovery in such a way, we've built upon these things, these foundations that were, you know, put, you know, the work has been done. I mean, the start of 12-step programs, you know, the scientific approach, learning more about how addiction affects the brain and alcoholism and treatment approaches. I mean, these things in these, you know, different centers like Hazelden or even, you know, like Betty Ford or whatever these different clinics have seen, and all of this information that's now at our fingertips. And then the power of the internet, you know, combined with a library of amazing, you know, literature that we can tap into, is that it's kind of a culmination of all of that work plus things that you've learned along the way. To create something that is more accessible without, I guess, the, you know, I mean, I said the modernization of it. I mean, I think that that's a really wild thing, man. I'm thoroughly impressed. I mean, how much time did you spend actually doing this research?
Oh, for the book? Let's see. Well, if you go back to, you know, I was running around the country going to neuroscience workshops starting back in 2012. I guess considerable, but it's my mission, Aaron. It's what I was put here to do, and I'm somebody who is blessed to have an inkling about my purpose in life, and it's also to help people to understand that not only, okay, is amazing recovery possible, because there are so many people out there in the depths of despair, under the jackboot of addiction, who don't even think, okay, in those rare moments of where the light of clarity shines, you know, into their addicted way of being, they don't even think, if I wanted to,
right,
how could I even, you know, so we really need something to step by step kind of thing. And there's you're right. There's so much amazing information out there, and you know, I haven't even begun, you know, to tabulate this. And you know, like I said, I'm on a mission to do this. I'm sure that there are many better suited than me. I just don't see them doing it. So, you know, I'm going to get off my ass and do something. And if I help, you know, a small handful of people,
then it'd be worth it, right?
And it's all worth it.
Well, and I think absolutely, that's really beautiful, Keith, is that here, you know, as we talk about this, you feeling called to do this, right? That you had a moment where you said, this is what I need to do. And, you know, that everything that led up to that day or that moment where you say, I'm going to take this responsibility moving forward, these things shape that in your experiences and in your, you know, childhood and your addictions or alcoholism and the change in that. So what I want to do is rewind the clock. I want to go back for a bit. I want to give the listeners an idea of who you are, where you're from, if you know, where'd you grow up?
I grew up not far from where I am right this minute. I'm in a small city north of Boston, and I grew up in a small, nice community, educated parents who were products of their times, the 60s. I kind of write about this in my first book, a little more biographical component. And this was, you know, sort of a breeding ground for, you know, the things that, you know, did my parents drop the ball with it? Well, they divorced. My mom drank. My father was, you know, sort of a product of his environment.
Right.
And which was his family fled the Nazis in pre-war Germany.
Oh, wow.
So I'm sure, you know, everybody sort of grows up to be what, you know, what they were fertilized with. And so I'm grew up in a time when, you know, all the expectations were on us, that we would, you know, just follow in that same kind of track and do one better than our parents did. And I wanted to play the drums in rock bands, and I, you know, pursued this, and there was a, of course, a fast and easy party component to this that I just, you know, started to, you know, fall into. It became enmeshed in my music, and so by the time I was 15 years old, a sophomore in high school, a weeknight would find me out playing in a bar, getting paid in drinks, and of course thinking, how great is this?
Right.
I'm hanging out with much older musicians and very serious about the music, but you know, the partying just took over. So, you know, fast forward a little bit. I went to Berklee College of Music for a short stint, didn't finish that, and did some traveling, playing in the region and actually out of country a little bit. And then through my 20s, it was just kind of a blur. And I started to, you know, drink myself and party myself out of opportunities. And so by the time I was 30, I had somehow, through no particular wisdom or insight of my own, stumbled into the medical field.
Okay.
I'd gone to a diploma program, become a surgical technologist. So I've got this sort of paradoxical two-world thing going on. I've got
right.
one foot in, you know, in healthcare, and a semi-respectable, and you know, could be stable there if it weren't for, you know, what my addiction. And that whole, you know, musical wild party person thing was doing to me. So, 30-ish, I crashed and burned. Bottom came, hospitalized myself. I had a meltdown. I was basically, I could not function in my job, my relationship, at every level of my life. I was circling the drain. And so I, you know, it was kind of a timeout, and I was not quite ready to embrace recovery. And
no,
admit,
I don't think a
know,
lot
that,
of us are, though, Keith. I mean, when it's just, go ahead. I was just thinking, like, when that stuff happens, I mean, you know, to be, like, jump in, you know, feet first, head first, however the vernacular is there, a lot of times that's not the case because we can't see our lives without it, right? We really
yeah,
can't.
No, it is a process akin to, you know, the slow turning around of a huge battleship. And for me, there was, you know, an orientation period where I was exposed to, you know, obviously in the time going back about almost 30 years, it was the traditional model, AA.
Right.
And that was the only avenue I was aware of. That was what the hospital sent me to. And I kind of, there was something about it that I sensed, you know, that piqued my curiosity. These people were doing something that I had no clue about. They were handling life on life's terms. They
right.
were solving their problems. They were getting along with each other. And as I came to hear the expression, they were intuitively handling
the situations that used to baffle them. Right.
Yeah, you got it. And so I wanted that. Yet I wanted that without doing what they did to get that, if you follow.
Right, it's so, like the American dream there.
here's the rub of the orientation period. I wanted what they had. I didn't want to do what they did. I set out to, you know, I'll be the first to figure that out. And, of course, I proved to myself that that's not how it works. And I learned all those lessons that the old school AA people talk about, you know, why you get a sponsor, why you go to meetings, why you get active, and how, you know, that first drink or drug will set in motion that whole crazy addictive process again. So I went along like that for a few months and then injured myself. I was out of work and it was just a long bender. And when I came, well, when I was ready to go back to work, I showed up basically not hungover, but really still intoxicated from drinking around the clock for 10 days.
Damn.
It was disgraceful, but this was that moment, that defining moment of truth for me where, you know, my manager was appalled. She just said, go hide somewhere. I got to talk to you. And I knew the jig was up, and I changed my clothes, and I snuck out the back door. Now, mind you, you know, we're talking about a hospital operating room.
Right.
Okay? Kind of a serious place where, you know, that stuff doesn't fly. So instead of waiting to be dressed down and, you know, yeah, there'd been the writing on the wall, and So I was now a cat who had squandered its eighth life, so right. to speak, out of the nine. And so I changed my clothes and went home and thought about ending it. You know, this was as low as it, you know, has
gone.
So
really
for
dark.
Me.
Well, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, though, in a lot of things. And I like that we're addressing this, especially because there's been some time separation from it. But the bottom line is this, like, your life was good until it wasn't, and it got really bad, especially when it revolving around alcohol. Trying to do this job in the medical industry and getting, you know, and having a lot of slaps on the wrist and then bad days and going back and forth to the point where, I mean, you couldn't see life moving forward. I mean, so dark in the day that you thought about ending it. I mean,
oh,
you know.
Precisely. And during the, you know, this time now, I can't really make a case for it being that wonderful. Okay. Because, you know, I had done the work and become, you know, a very competent musician, yet the opportunities, I was shooting myself in the foot. And the basic things in life that, you know, that this is what I saw when I started looking at recovery and the meetings and the people. Yeah, man, I had lowered my expectations. I brought my dreams in line down with what was possible
right.
in my addictive way of being. And the things that, you know, that we all hope to pursue, just, you know, the basic, like you said, the American dream, a family life, a stable, productive existence, you know, were just somehow off the table. So, no, I certainly wouldn't make a case that, you know, things were wonderful, but all the weight of my addictive way of being and what I really just tried to kid myself, the delusion is that, I'm a guy who drinks and uses drugs because, you know, I have problems. No, I have problems because I
drink, right.
drugs. Yeah. and so this epiphany, you know, in that moment, and I knew where there was one guy I could call, because that was, you know, just one of those suggestions I had completely ignored. And I, you know, made that phone call, and that was, you know, the first day of my recovery.
Do you ever feel like when you look back, because I know I experienced this myself, is that that you were able to figure it out on your own, that it's based with, you know, your own research. And you said you were trying to figure out a different way. Like, I don't want to go do it like that, that can't be the right answer to this, that you could maybe intellectualize the sickness and the disease at the time and go your own route. But you were just beaten into submission and realizing, well, maybe I should try one of these things that has already been laid out in front of me. Did you run through that a lot?
I think that's another delusion, and there's another paradox in here, in that, okay, so an addiction in one sense is me taking something outside of myself to change my internal state. Okay,
true.
But to shift that, I, again, need a greater resource. Okay, and there's a lot of, you know, ways to flip that. Okay, a God of my understanding, a power greater than myself, a higher power. You know, there's that, but I look at it as, okay, I needed some kind of outside resource when I look back and I categorize it into, you know, kind of generic terms. So, you know, I talked about trying to figure out an easier way. And for me, there was, you know, abstinence was the only path, that there was no controlling this beast for me.
Right.
You know, which is today is, you know, it's debated and I, you know, I'm very open-minded about all the,
but
you know,
for you
the
as an individual.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so I have no black and whites about this today. But for me at the time, the path of abstinence and pursuing a here's how we do it version of recovery, you know, was the best path. And so I made my way in recovery and, you know, took suggestions, kind of rolled up my sleeves, jumped in with both feet after I became ready, like we talked
right.
about. And so things started to improve. Of course, I had this big jackpot, and I went in, you know, to work, and I took responsibility.
Mm.
And it's kind of liberating that, okay, my ships are burned. Okay, I just used life number, you know, I'm on my ninth life.
Right. I don't have anything, like, I have to do this now. I get that.
Yep.
I know that feeling.
Yep. The only way is forward. And so I did this, and I, you know, I got a permanent sponsor and started doing the work and got active in the community. of recovery, and pretty soon I was doing things like going back to school, buying a house,
right,
quitting smoking, starting to work out, and you know, so 5 years or so, I'm sitting in front of my home group, kind of, you know, measuring here's today and here's 5 years ago, the first time I sat in the same room feeling and looking like a cat had just barfed me up.
Yeah.
And, you know, profound stuff. And I just, you know, finished this intensive registered nursing program at a local college. I'm ready to embark on a new career. And I'm, you know, I'm reflecting on this. And all of a sudden, you know, my life goes from 60 to, you know, zero because I was so busy working full time. Operating room job, well over, you know, there's a call component and school and household recovery, of course, you know, getting to, you know, a minimum necessary amount of meetings and connections with a sponsor and, you know, all that. And then I kind of stop and I have time to look around. You know, I'm 5 years in now.
Yeah.
And it's going really well. Hey, oh, you mean everybody doesn't succeed like this? And I, you know, scratched my head about this. And I kind of like, no, everybody relapses a bunch of times and struggles. And so a little survivor guilt set in. But this is where this questioning of, you know, not just why me, but why not everybody?
Yeah, I get
okay?
that.
Nothing special about me, except, you know, I'm competent, I can follow directions after a fashion and get by. You know, I'm not the best nurse, I wasn't the best musician, and I'm not the best author and expert. But, you know, what's the deal? How can we, it just became that little itch in the middle of my brain that I wanted to find out. What can we do? What can I do? What can be done?
Got ya. Well, I think that's actually a really interesting thing, because as you were saying that, like, you were looking at your life, you know, what it was like 5 years ago from that point in time, all the amazing things that have happened since then, going back to school, working, having a program of recovery, buying a house. I mean, it all does is remind me of my own life. And I think to myself, like, all of the amazing things, and I'm coming up on 3 years, right, of within that. All of the just it's hard to put into words sometimes. I mean, I could sit here and give you a laundry list of all the different things that have happened. But it is frankly amazing. And at times I'll look at that and say, well, why me as opposed to that other person? So there are always going to be aspects of that were very baffling to me anyway. Like, I don't think it was, oh, God loves me more than he loves this other person or this or that. I mean, it's just the fact of how recovery works. When you go and you show up and you do the right thing, your life's going to get better. That's a very simple explanation of life in general. The only different component is, like, I know that for me, and what I've seen in this is that the helping of others is what makes it even more profound than just existing. Because I have friends, I have buddies who are in recovery who really just are not drinking or not using, and their lives aren't that great other than the fact that they're not doing that. So there are things, the action put forth, actually putting in the work and helping someone else, that allows your life to really blossom into other things. So when you point these things out, I think it's important, one, from a listener to understand, like, there is more than just not drinking. There's more than just not using. There's got to be something else behind that. But you can't do any of those other things until you stop that. So that's kind of like at least a catalyst in my mind and how to break these things down. But I think it's really cool that now at that point you're like, so you're trying to figure out ways for, you know, why this thing works. What is it about it? What is the cognitive behavioral therapy of it? Is it, you know, is it this? Is it that? Like, what is the component that allows people's lives to get better or to have? Because it's a mindset, too. It's not just the action.
Everything you just said, all right, yes and no.
Okay.
So,
break it down for me, Keith.
Most people kind of come in, engage in the process, and it's okay if I go to some meetings, get a sponsor, do what everybody else does. And to a certain degree, that means saying the same things everybody else is saying.
Gotcha.
And, Okay. So, but you know, randomly engage in this process. It could go really well, or it could go really flat. And the random approach has yielded random results. So, where I've kind of gone with this is to get a little. Let's get a little more specific.
Okay.
Let's figure out what. Okay. That traditional model. That's what I call it now. It's just, you know, it's 80 years old. It's, you know, it's done the best for the most for the longest. It has been quantified, and you know, it's really just there's a top of the iceberg, and underneath is a lot of it's not working for a lot of people, unfortunately.
Okay. That's true.
So, but what about it is working? Well, I broke that down to five basic, I call them pillars of recovery. I write about them in the new book. Community, yes. People engage in a community of recovery, and the principal means of doing this is, you know, going to a meeting every day. But do I need to go to a meeting every day, or do I need to engage in a community of like-minded people who are thinking the same way and, you know, looking to attain the same objectives? And that would be more, you know, the case than, you know, and when you lay at some people's doorstep that they, you know, that they think that their life is going to be a succession of daily meetings going off into the forever, that's a daunting prospect that sends many people headed in the other direction. So community, very, very important. Knowledge, okay. The traditional model knows a lot about the diseases of addiction, whether they, you know, they, the disease model came later, of course, but they know that it's not going to get better by itself, that it needs to be addressed in some, you know, daily way, and that more has to change than just, you know, putting down the substance.
Right.
Other pillars would be some kind of belief system. Doesn't have to be you know, religious based, but you know what it could involve the larger questions. What's, you know, the meaning of life? What am I doing with my life? And if you incorporate that in, then this sort of gives you a larger, you know, perspective on what you're doing in recovery. Mentoring, okay? Maybe not necessarily a sponsor who supervises your recovery on a, you know, a daily basis, but a role model or a positive influence, or, you know, somebody to kind of bounce things off of. You know, I had a sponsor for, well, every day I've been in recovery. And a year and a half ago, we kind of went through a little rocky time and came out of that. He tells me now, all right, we're friends. I'm not your sponsor anymore. I can no longer, you know, teach you things the way I used to teach you.
That.
But is he still my mentor? Of course.
Right.
You know, he's just a...
I've experienced,
you know,
that myself, Keith. So I get it. I know what you're saying. Well, just in the aspects of, like, you know, what I needed right out the gate is different than what I need today. I need a lot of the same things, but some of those same things that I know just from the repeated, it's interesting. So, like, the sponsor I have, I still have a sponsor. I still talk to him. Still, you know, there's more of a mentoring relationship, friendship now. But, you know, a lot of these, the things that I've learned is, like, before I go and reach out, why don't I just challenge my thought process here, or just talk to anybody, whoever I can get a hold of, and just say, look, I got to get this ugliness out of me for a second, just to make sure I'm thinking about this correctly, and then keep it pushing. But my life, you know, or even the meeting idea, like, yeah, you know what? I still get to meetings myself. I still belong to a 12-step, but I also do other things, including this show and reaching out to people on a daily basis, that aspects of community. And, you know, my concept of a higher power, what drives me, has continued to evolve. Like, so, I mean, a lot of these things that you're breaking down are evident in my own life. And I think that's really cool, because You know, here you've taken this existing model, right? This something that this is the only way that it works and it has to be this way. And you're saying, well, that's not necessarily true. It can be these other things as well. And you're giving somebody an opportunity or a different option for a life of recovery. And I think that's like the crux of this. It's what you said, you know, when we started this conversation off, you're showing evidence of that. I am on board with what you're saying. It's just the breakdown of how you came to these things.
So breaking these things down to a more generic or
right.
categorical, okay, and now define that, you know, instructing the person entering recovery, here's the gist of what you're trying to do. This is, you know, the traditional model has presented it as this, but define this for yourself.
Right.
And you know, one of my biggest mottos is that everybody should have an individualized program of recovery that is attenuated to their specific circumstances, that works for them. And as you, you know, let me just, before we move on, the last pillar of recovery is, and you spoke to this already, service, the win-win-win proposition of service. It's good for the person I serve. It's good for me. It's good for the community. So yeah, service would be the other.
Well, I think it's huge too. I think it's a huge part of that pillar because it's such a baffling idea to think the more I help others, the more I'm helped in return. Because people, I don't think that we typically look at stuff like that. You know, yeah, I'm going to go and donate my time or, you know, this to somebody else. And then to realize that the benefit of that, you know, and they've talked about like getting outside of your own head is one. But for whatever reason, I don't know if it's just the way that the planets align or nature itself has a way of paying that back with dividends that are well worth the price of admission.
Karma, sure.
Yeah. And that's funny because I'm not like, oh, karma's a big thing. Well, no, it actually, it speaks to it. If you're putting good out there and genuinely wanting to help other people, you get the help. And you might not be able to see it as it's happening, but there will be situations that whether, you know, and maybe it's the small successes of life. Maybe it's, you know, someone observes that doesn't really have a day-to-day part of your life, but sees that you're doing something and provides an opportunity as a result. Like that's at least happened in my life. I see it happening in other people. So, yeah, I think that's a strong thing. And I always tend to hit on that because I say it in my episodes. Like, look, go help somebody. In turn, it's going to help you. It's like the circle of recovery. You call it a pillar. I think that's a strong because it holds up this foundation. Like, recovery's on the top. Here's the five pillars that are going to allow you to have this new life. So.
Perfect, Aaron. Yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
Maybe I should write a book. No, I'm kidding.
I strongly suspect you will someday.
Yeah, at some point. Once I'm done, when I get bored talking, maybe, or if I have the time to. Right now, it's just my hands are in so many different things that I'm just trying to get it all off the ground.
Well, communication is very important for us right now because we were talking about this before you hit the on switch. There's so much misinformation today, and you know, people are living in stigma. The average person out there doesn't understand the problem. They don't understand the solution, and unfortunately, nobody can hide in degrees of separation anymore.
Right.
It's everybody is pretty closely connected to somebody who has been directly affected. So that makes everybody indirectly affected, and that means that we are all in the same village, and it takes a village to recover. So the more the village knows about recovery, well, the better it's going to go.
Well, I think let's speak on that then. I mean, let's take this chance to deviate. I mean, what are you seeing are the issues surround like currently? What are the problems? What is the thing that's promoted that's misinformation or wrong, from your opinion, from your viewpoint?
Well, and this ties right into my recovery model. There's a belief that change is so fundamentally difficult that a lot of people struggling with addiction or would be inclined to say, what's the point of trying? And I'm here to say that, you know, the latest teachings and research in the areas of neuroscience tell us that the brain can change, adapt, grow, heal, repair itself throughout the lifespan. And you know, so this is the neuroplasticity is the term that they use for that. And I, you know, in my writing, I am very careful not to go all out science-y.
Yeah, because you're going to lose people. You won't lose me, but you will. Some people are like, that's too heady for me. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I had, with my first book, I had 105,000 words to warm up with. And I kind of break it down and point out, you know, if you think about it, okay, take gravity. They don't know how it works, but we go up and down in airplanes every day. The Apollo astronauts flew to the moon and back safely, but they couldn't design, build, engineer, test. You know, they were just good pilots, okay? They didn't know how to do the math, and neither do we to get the benefits, but we just have to warm up and be willing to learn just enough how to work with some of these things. So neuroplasticity tells me that, yeah, the brain can heal, it can reconnect its wiring, and I can also disconnect old useless wiring, the behaviors of addiction. So if you think about a nerve cell, which kind of resembles a wire,
okay,
when I want to learn a new behavior, the one I like to talk about is driving, because it's so common to everybody. And you think about the first time you got behind the wheel of a car, and you said, oh, crap,
this
Dad
is
makes this look so easy. And then you realize you were confronted with the pedals, the steering, the shifter, turning the engine on, the rules of the road, your destination, trying not to kill people. And it's, you have to think about everything, and you are basically, you're unskilled, and you're unconscious of it. You don't even know what you don't know yet. So fast forward to us as adults. We get in the car. You're thinking about a key card or something, and you know, you just go to your destination, and unless something strange happened, you just get there, and you did it automatically.
Right.
A different part of your brain actually did this. And that starts out, you know, in your brain looking like, you know, like a thin wire, but the brain wants to work smart instead of working hard.
Correct.
So what starts out as the equivalent of a little footpath, you know, in your central nervous system gets gradually widened and expanded to a superhighway, which can handle the traffic. Okay, and if, you know, whether it's, you know, a musician learning how to play a new song or learning how to drive a car or learning the skills of recovery, okay, this is how our brains will handle it. All we have to do is practice this a certain way, which I think is really cool because it's one of those kind of methodical things that can take all the randomness out of recovery.
Right. Well, I kept thinking as you're saying, but what about the bad drivers out there, Keith? What about you know what I mean? What about the ones, and you know they exist because I know they exist. You're like, how on earth are you that bad at this? Maybe because they're distracted and they're looking at their phones or, you know, whatever it may be. But, you know, there's definitely bad drivers. And I don't want to necessarily compare that to recovery. But then again, it might be the people out there with the misinformation. You know what I mean? Maybe that's the way to do it.
It's a precise comparison because, you take bad information and feed it in, and you're going to get a bad result out, or certainly a less than optimal. So you got this, you know, capacity to learn new information and develop new skills, and you go from, you know, not knowing what you don't know, unskilled, unconscious, to, let me get this right, unconsciously skilled. All right.
Okay.
You don't have to think about it, but you do it automatically. And this is possible in driving. It's possible in recovery.
Yeah, you could even take that point a step further with the autonomous vehicle idea. Is that if we can program cars to drive themselves, right, to be aware of everything around it, then I'm pretty sure, and the human brain figured these things out. Somebody figured out how to do that for a vehicle. Then, you know what? It allows the guesswork to be taken out of it. Like, this is something that has been created. This is a new pathway that's been developed that frees up your own mind to be more aware of other things. I'm just saying.
Well, this is an analogy I've made. You can turn your sobriety and your recovery into an engine that drives itself.
There you go.
A perpetual motion machine. I've done it. I know people who have done this and applied it to all these other forms of illness and life problems. And it's time somebody harnessed this technology, this new understanding, and adapted it to the needs, circumstances, problems, the specific issues of the addictive illness population. So, you know, your brain can become a beautiful new thing, and this is true of anybody. You know, I used to know people who thought they were, you know, they were brain damaged, and yeah. We used to joke when we'd be out behind the high school, you know, smoking a fatty. Yeah, there goes another 50,000 brain cells, man.
Just gone, bro. Well, no, I mean,
and yeah. We were kidding, but we kind of believed that's how it was, and it's not. And the same thing is true of our genetics. Everybody wants to, you know, throw genetics under the bus as the cause of, yeah, okay, so, yeah, dad drank and mom took drugs, so I must have the drunken junkie gene.
Okay.
And it's not true unless I believe it is. And this is why this has been a hard one to shift. The theory of epigenetics has been out there for a couple of decades now, and this is one of the slow, you know that in... in science, it takes a while for the science to get to the academic.
Correct.
And then to get into the
well, it has
the
to be debated and figured out. I mean,
knowledge. Yeah.
Correct.
And of course, you know, people with careers and reputations and research grants. And
right.
Yeah, they're going to kick and scream. And one of the famous physicists, I think it was Niels Bohr, said, it's not like a whole generation of experts are just going to suddenly say, oh, we were wrong.
Right.
We gotta kind of wait for them to get out of the way and the new people. I heard you had a show with a doctor who was talking about this, and he said it's been so slow in the addictive medicine field, and I'm inclined to agree. But genetics, okay, we do not necessarily – we rewrite our genetic blueprint almost daily, and this happens with our thoughts, our environment, our choices. And, you know, so people have always believed that, okay, yeah, dad had a heart attack at 50 and mom was diabetic. And it does happen that way when we believe it, because we make choices that will result in that outcome. Well, it's my genetics, can't be helped. It's the luck of the draw. So I might as well kick back, grab the remote control, have another piece of pie, and not do anything about it.
Right.
And this, you know, this has to shift. And so we need to get this information out that we actually do rewrite our genetic blueprint. And the way this works is, okay, if I think a thought, it sends an electrochemical signal to somewhere in my body, and a neuropeptide is produced, or a hormone or a chemical of some kind, you know, and it creates a feeling in
right.
my body. And this feeling would reinforce the thought. And pretty soon I get a feedback loop going. And this is actually the cause of so much human suffering in the form of anxiety and depression, something that's so common to the addiction population. But this same technology, the same circumstance, or what's the word I'm looking for, the same action.
Right, same treatment for the thing, like, that's not really doing anything about it.
But the same principle can be flipped, and we can intentionally focus our thoughts on ways that are going to recondition our body to actually be the body of our potential future.
Okay.
And sort of the last piece of the theory, as it goes, is that in the new physics of quantum mechanics, there are a couple of principles that are good to have just a simple understanding of. Entanglement. Once two objects are in a relationship, and this works on the very small and also the very large, this relationship will be constant. And once one action is placed on one part of the system, it affects instantaneously the other part of the system, regardless of its location and space.
And that can be like a vast distance, right? I mean, I've read
yeah.
something, and I just for my understanding purpose, because I know what you're referring to, but I'm trying to think of how that it seems a little too smart for my pay grade at the moment.
If you could break they've done experiments with little subatomic particles called photons, spinning in one direction, and they change the spin and another one 14 miles away instantaneously. Which all the old physicists says, oh, that's impossible, because that means something is traveling faster than light.
Right.
And, well, I'm sorry, but it's no longer impossible. And now it's been done with larger objects. They're taking this up in scale, and we are made of those subatomic particles.
Correct.
That's two. The one other piece to this is time. And this is the thing that we structure our reality with. We've got this relationship with it. The past moves into the present and then moves ahead to the future.
Okay.
And our relationship with this is very strict. Okay. We without really thinking about it, we define this as, okay, I remember the past, and in this moment in the present, I could do something that would influence the future.
Right. I get that.
I can't influence the past, and I can't remember the future.
Mm. Okay.
And in the quantum model, okay, this is... this is not written in stone, so that's pretty cool, and it does have as we look at how this works in practice, to go through the process of following these step by step directions I lay out and change that being entangled
okay.
to things regardless of where they are in space and time. Has certain conveniences. It really, okay, so given choice between that, go to a meeting every day, talk to my sponsor, keep it in the present moment form of recovery, or a recovery with unlimited possibilities where I can connect to the life and recovery of my dreams, where my genetics does not rule me, where I can reshape, resculpt, and remodel my brain and thought process. Well, it's a no-brainer for me. That's the version of recovery I want.
I get it. And it's really interesting though, Keith, is that as you're saying things like the way my own brain works, and I start thinking of how this is already happening in the lives of like myself and others. I mean, I'll just bring it into just my own life. And how my thought processes have already changed, right? How recovery itself and these things that you've discussed are something that's already being applied in my own life, and thinking before I act, or processing it, reaching out to somebody. It's like I became conditioned to go about this differently, and that was a learned skill. It wasn't my first choice. It wasn't my first thought. But now, as time has moved forward, and I've seen successes within these things, I just do those. I mean, why it's really important, even just in terms of an ethical conversation, why it's so important to be honest. Well, that way I don't have to remember the lies that I've told. And I can
keep your story straight. Right.
I mean, like that within itself, I mean, people can understand that, because you can see, a direct result with that. There's other parts, though, that are really because a lot of times we can't see what the future holds, right? I can't see what by doing this, what's going to happen tomorrow. My hope is that it gets better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that that's something that people often forget. Like there's that instant gratification component of addiction that says we know how this is going to make you feel right now. And I talk to people about this all the time. Like it's so insanely difficult, especially that first week, even first month of saying, dude, trust me, it will get better. And now having experienced that, it's like I'm completely on board, because it's true. My life has gotten tremendously better as a result of very simple things to do and things that I didn't understand at the time, but I did them anyway. The blind faith. But now, as I have been in recovery longer, and the things that I've witnessed for myself, and this idea, like you've talked about, having a very individualized program of recovery, I'm on board with that 100%. That's a huge reason I do this show and say, look, I don't know, what I do is mine. It's for me, right? And it may not work for somebody else. The way that I approach my day or approach other people But there's a common theme in all of these is, you know, like the giving back, these pillars you've talked about. Like that's those are the similarities in people who have a life of recovery. And I think that that within itself and saying, look, you can go this route. You can do AA, NA. You could do this. It doesn't matter. You can do whatever. Or even you talked about like with people, you know, it's no longer black and white where you're saying like, oh, medically assisted is a wrong thing. Well, it didn't work for me, but I can't say that for somebody else. I can't say that that's, you know, going to keep them.
No, we can't take anything off the table.
No.
These days. No. So what you were just like getting at, and I really understand this, is the conditioning that we are, you know, how we're educated, how we're brought up, how we're socialized. And it's very specific. By the time we are, a certain age, Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy have all gone away. Okay,
right.
And there's no such thing as magic.
Right.
And then, you know, the abstract of something outside me to change how I feel inside me. And you know, how simple the instant gratification of that, cause and effect.
Right.
In its simplest manifestation. So what we need to learn to do, and this is you know what I'm advocating here, is to stop living by cause and effect and start learning how to cause an effect.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the game changer. And people, you know, it wasn't on the 6 o'clock news that we can change our genetic expression. It's not on the 6 o'clock news that everything is fundamentally connected at the most basic level. And this means you and I are connected. This means me and whatever creative intelligence of the universe is doing all this are connected. And, you know, and how we used to think that every day of our addicted lives was a turd sandwich and every day was another bite. And it's just not that way anymore once you begin to open your mind to the possibilities of this, you know, I call it infinite recovery because nothing is off the table. So you said, you know, how your recovery is unfolded. But in the quantum model, okay, where our consciousness and how we observe things dictates how our reality is.
Get that.
What's possible, Aaron?
Hmm.
Anything
right.
is possible. Okay, you or I, either one of us could still possibly be president, and maybe one of us should be. Because anyway, no, I'm not going to go there. Not going to go there.
That's my other podcast.
But you know what I'm saying.
No, absolutely. So, like I mean, it truly, so, in that sense, that anything is possible. And you, look, so, I get that. I do.
So what I'm explaining how to do here is to connect to those future possibilities. Now, I know future is a little bit of a dirty word in the traditional model. You know, for time is there's a paradox there in the traditional model because they put a lot of emphasis on it
today,
while at the same time saying keep it in the day, 24
right. Well,
hours,
and I
one
get
day
that.
At a time.
Well, because when you start, I mean, and I understand from the thought process of like living in tomorrow is not going to help me. Like me thinking about this, you know, and I think it's more with like the worrying or all of that, or like living in the past.
Oh, yes, anxiety.
Like, that's
thinking about
the thing.
Thinking about the future. Something went horribly right. wrong in the past. I'm afraid it's going to happen again in the future, and that is the letter definition of anxiety. If you want to throw in some sweaty palms and a stomach in knots, depression is, you know, perseverating on the past and things that went wrong. And you know, if I'm doing that, I am giving all my mental energy to anything but the present moment. And early in recovery, when it's a struggle, when you're white knuckling it, it is so important to respect yourself, even take pride, a word, you know, we have to be careful with.
Yeah, the healthy pride.
In staying sober for 1 hour, one day, yes. But in the longer frames of cycles of time, which, again, that's an agreement. We structure our reality with time. In the longer cycles of this, the change, like me from, you know, my first day to 5 years later in the same room, okay, you with me on that?
Yeah.
You know, you see the change. And after after a point, after I'm doing it, okay, maybe that rigid one day at a time living could hamper my possibilities, okay? And so that dirty word, future, like it or not, the future is coming.
Correct.
And that's, you know, that. So what about connecting to, instead of that random outcome, what about connecting to the future possibilities, the future recovery of my dreams? What if I get a little more proactive and thinking that, okay, well, that universe that used to just, you know, be a turd sandwich every day is actually kind of neutral and will support me if I, you know how to, you know, work with the system. And it sort of offers the possibility of more of a collaborative relationship with that something greater, that higher power, that God of your understanding, or whatever that looks like for you. Not advocating one viewpoint over another, but just that there, you know, I'm saying there probably is something underlying all this, you know, whether you want to call it the matrix or the zero point field, or
right.
there's something that, you know, is facilitating this. I think about, you know, the life force that is in both of us, and, you know, my heart will beat like 3 billion times in my lifetime. No, 3 trillion, sorry. And pump gallons of blood through miles of blood vessels. If you took the DNA in all my cells and uncoiled it, it would reach to the sun and back.
I mean, it's baffling, right? I mean, when you start we are
such miracles, and, you know, I'm not doing that. Something greater than me definitely is.
No, I mean, that's that to me, I'm completely on board with, because there's so much that we don't know. And it's just like, and I like daydreaming about this or pontificating and all these other things about what life and the meaning and how we're even here and the electricity that goes through our bodies. Like, it's a beautiful mystery, right? And that mystery is, I don't know. You're much, much better versed on talking about this, because all I can do is think about it at the moment, and it's making my words jumble up a little bit, because it is a beautiful thing, and it is wild, and it is deep and you know, profound, and all of these different things like that. So I have to ask, though, how do you see these things, especially when it comes to, like, with your book and implementing this into, like, treatment centers and people? Like, how would you suggest that they start applying these things at a ground level?
I'm glad you asked, Aaron, because these are wonderful philosophical things to talk about. And the wonder of existence and life and recovery is really cool stuff. But, you know, we still got this traditional 12-step model of recovery that is working for 7.5% of people that attempt it. We've got a medical model that calls addiction a disease. Now, that's okay. Scientists and researchers look at scans of people's brains, and they see deterioration. They see changes. They see pathology. And this is where their idea that addiction is a disease comes from. So if they have labeled it a disease, well, that makes it part of the medical model, and they're responsible for treating that.
Gotcha.
How's that working out? Yeah. The legal system, which would have, you know, the everybody who says addiction is a choice, the legal system is holding people responsible for things that go wrong when they're in the throes of addiction. And, you know, it's certainly emphasizing incarceration over rehabilitation, although, you know, we're starting to see some small shifts there. But for the most part, you know, again, how's that working out? I'll take a carrot on a stick over the stick,
yeah,
any day. Okay, so the negative reinforcement thing, certainly, you know, you could look at, you know, the wonderful model of Portugal and how they have, by merely decriminalizing, okay, they stopped marginalizing the addict and making society's most vulnerable people the biggest victims, okay, and devoting the resources that they used to devote to prosecution and, you know, pursuing and enforcement, they turn that into resources for treatment and rehabilitation. And their crime has gone down, their drug use has gone down, their health problems like HIV have gone down, their crime has not gone up. And one of the biggest differences is that the children in the schools are looking at this whole conversation in a much different context. And they will engage and they will, you know, discuss the pros and cons. Well, what's the difference between drug use and addiction?
Right.
Within earshot of teachers and authority figures. Okay. And this, you know, this isn't happening here in the States. They're still baffled about how to, you know, they want to go into the schools and say, don't take drugs, kids. And, you know, it harkens back to the just say no.
Yeah, the
your
DARE
brain
program,
on drugs.
Don't hit the red button. I mean,
yeah.
No, you're right. Well, this is this type of thing. Interestingly, you bring it up because, you know, I believe last year, maybe the year before that, we had on the ballot here in Cincinnati was the decriminalization for possession of narcotics at a certain amount. And that would treat it as a misdemeanor or, you know, as a public health crisis as opposed to criminality. And what people, and it's a beautiful thing because it was a comparison, especially myself being in recovery and seeing the other aspects of this that are deeper than just the surface, I realize it's a really positive thing that's going to help people. Well, unfortunately, because of, you know, stigma and, you know, what people see on the news, it was, oh my gosh, there's going to be, you know, who on earth, if they have 6 grams of fentanyl on them, they're probably a drug dealer. They're just going to put all those guys in treatment or this, this, and that. Like, there's this strong group of people who just want to kill every, you know, like, want everybody just to die off in that, or they want to put the people in prison for the rest of their lives. And I remember this, like, fell apart completely. I'm like, did you guys even really read what that was all about? Do you even see how this one thing was, it was a monumental change. And it, yes, it failed, and I understand why. But people are very short-sighted, and maybe just because of what's been beat into them for years, or, you know, the argument that, you know, choice or disease and the things that you've brought up, I just, I don't know how long that takes. I do know that there's people in play here, and the beautiful thing about living where I do is that the recovery groups and people on the front lines are very vast. There's a lot of us that are trying to hit, you know, attack this thing head on, myself included. And, you know, I think that they're working at it from different angles because there's plenty of different problems, but trying to change an entire country of people to get on board with it is a tall order that may not happen for a while. I believe it will at some point. It's just, we're like laying the groundwork now.
Oh, we absolutely are. And there are, you know, I think whether it's in infrastructure or just people in general, or, well, even trickling into elements of the recovery community, okay, nobody's denying that the problem's here, but people seem to kick and scream when the solution comes knocking on the door.
Right.
The local mayor here, you know, He knows we have the problem, but he didn't want that clinic moving into town because the neighbors and political expediency, and, you know, it's
just it's the issue that we're faced with. I mean, you know what I'm go ahead. You're
well, people like you, people like me, who are doing what we do, are one of the, I think we're one of the biggest antidotes to stigma there is. Okay, in my own case, I am openly in recovery. Okay, I am no longer anonymous. My last name, real last name, is Keller. Back in 2014, I wasn't ready to take that on, thinking it would alienate a bunch of my possible reading audience. I wrote under a pseudonym, and have rethought this, and it's really important. It does not serve people or the greater good when people like me with established recovery, who are, I'm a registered nurse. I'm a member of the community. I'm your neighbor. I take care of you, your children, your parents in hospitals, facilities, your homes. And recovery has made that possible. And you know, that is a real kick in the, you know what, to stigma when people are doing this. Look at you, 3 years into recovery. You're completely out in the open. You're doing this valuable work. Communicating all, you know, representations of all the moving parts of the problem, the more we do this, you know, the better it's going to get. There was a great thinker named Stefan Schwartz, who's written some books, and he looked at the commonalities of small groups of people who affected big social change, and he boiled it down to like 8 principles. And one of them is that we have to be willing, you know, to be committed enough to do this work, knowing that we may not be around to see the outcome.
Right.
And that's
huge.
You know, it's that selfless, you know, dedication to what we're doing that we, you know, those of us who are really committed, we don't think twice about that.
No, as you said when we first started this conversation off, that you've been called to do something. And that's one of the things that I've talked to with other people that, you know, that obviously aren't doing the same thing you are, but in the for the greater good here, everybody's been called to do this. And I find that in the supernatural very interesting, right? That all of us have this certain voice or epiphany that says, I have to do something. I can't just sit idly by. This is the gift that I have, and yours doing the research and writing, and mine using my voice specifically, you know, or this person to, you know, work with law enforcement. There's so many of these different things that people are like, I have to. It's my goal. I have people. There's a gentleman who came on my show that hasn't even had any issues with substance use, yet he is showing that people change. He's doing a video series called the Addiction Series. And you're like, this is, why would you spend so much time doing that? You spend all your money. It has, you know, I find that really cool and really beautiful and how many people are actually doing something. Then you have the flip side of that, people that are just trying to specifically profit off of individuals' despair and, you know, the addictions and, I mean, you know, housing or whatever it is. Then you have that component. That's just going to creep in just like anything else. I just think that we greatly outweigh that, and as more of these voices seem to come out of the shadows, it's going to be more and more effective. I mean, which is kind of where I think leads into another thing, like what the existing model of traditional recovery programs say, look, you know, you are a part of, you're not, you know, this thing, this anonymous group, and you should protect that for this group itself. And they're not, people aren't recovering out loud. Like mine, while I don't talk about the program of recovery I do, I'm out. Obviously, people know my name, know what I do. I have a show, like all these things. Why do you think that is no longer effective to hide in the shadows or in church basements? What is it that you? What is your opinion on that?
Well, it still is a necessary component for many.
Okay.
And I just was accosted the other day.
I get it all the time.
Who I wasn't even talking about anonymity, and he came up and he, you know, the Supreme Court, blah blah blah. They'll kill us if we come out. And I, well, all right. I appreciate your opinion, but the people who are saying it can't be done should not get in the way of the people who are doing it anyway. That was my response to him. So I was in Chicago a couple of years ago and had a discussion meeting where anonymity came up, and one fellow says, I sell insurance and mortgages in this town. I need to be anonymous. And his recovery is contingent on his belief in how it needs to work. Okay, sometimes we have to believe things before we can see them. That's definitely something I, you know, believe in and endorse. My job, what I see as my mission, is to make the world a place where he'll feel safe. Whether he's anonymous or not, it's going to shift very slowly. The traditional model, you know, once people invest in that, okay, they're all in. And you know how it is nowadays, everything's personal, and people really have little tolerance for dissenting or diverging opinions.
Right.
Unfortunately, it's kind of a thing of the times. That it's just another working condition for people like us, that's how it is. And that's what we have to work with. Doesn't change anything for me. Doesn't mean I'm not going to step up and say, yep, I'm in recovery. I'm not going anywhere. You know, there's nothing to fear from me. I'm, you know, serving a greater good, and you know, people just need to warm up to this idea, I guess.
Well, I think that it's rolling back to what I was saying a little bit ago about being called to do something. I think just as much as anybody could have this epiphany to create a program that talks, I mean, years ago, 80 years ago, and say this is how we're going to do it, and for it to make, you know, a lot of impact, but yet it to be in 2019, the way our social fabric works with, you know, social media and, you know, people sharing clean times and the amount of the opioid epidemic or pandemic being as big as it is, I think it was, you know, it's almost supposed to happen in such a way that people come out of the woodwork and say, look, no, I am recovering. I have been through this. It's just the difference in what to be called to do that. I've just as much as that person 80 years was to say, you know, we're going to do something about it. We're doing the same thing today. It's just we live in a different world. And people, you know, I'm trying to, I know how to say these things, but for whatever reason, my brain doesn't want to put them all together. I need to really rebuild those pathways. No, I'm serious. No,
I got a book for you, Aaron.
Well, right. And that's the key thing here. I think it's really cool, Keith. I mean, as we bring this towards kind of the end of our conversation, and there's things that I wanted to give you a platform. You have a quote that, you know, when you were texting me, it says, you know, that addiction does not fit into any box. It defies classification and categorization. The well-meaning attempts to define it haven't made inroads in solving the problem. And that goes on for a bit, which I will, when you break this whole thing down, you know, it does not fit into any box. What do you really mean by addiction does not fit into any box?
Well, the medical model wants to define it as a disease. The civil model wants to define it as a legal issue. The traditional model wants to define it as a spiritual malady. Okay. It's not an illness. Or it's more. It is an illness, but it's more. It is a behavior, but it's more than a psychological problem. It's more than a, you know, a societal issue. It ought to have its own bigger definition somehow. So synonymous in people's minds when the word addiction, you know, they're going to think of something bigger than a disease or illness. They're going to think of something bigger than a moral failing. Any grouping of words that form a definition of addiction has not fully served it.
I get it.
Up to this time.
No, and it doesn't encapsulate all the problems. Like if there's a lot of moving parts that we've discussed and how you broke that down, I think I like to expand upon that at some point. But what I ask of all my guests, and I'm asked the same thing of you, if you could say something to someone who's still struggling, what would that be?
That recovery is absolutely possible. You have to believe it before you can see it. But recovery is a skill that anyone can learn. Anyone.
Well, there you go. From the author of the Infinite Recovery Handbook, you got a website out there, which is www.infiniterecovery.org, as well as a Facebook group that I am a part of, is the Infinite Recovery Support and Discussion Group. I know that you're adding new members every week. Is there anything else, like ways that people can get in contact with you or find your book?
The book is available on Amazon. If you Google Keith Keller author or author Keith Keller, there's a rehab in Texas that is called Infinite Recovery, and they got .com. So I'm .org. And Aaron, I just need to commend you again on the amazing job you're doing. You are helping people in ways that we can't even fathom right here, right now. And I'm just so grateful to have this opportunity to speak with you about this stuff. Like I said earlier, it is my mission. So thank you for letting me pursue my mission today.
No, it's awesome, man.
So grateful.
Thanks for being a part of it. I mean, one of the coolest things about this is I get to meet amazing people like yourselves that help me. This really ultimately helps me at the end of the day too, because then it helps my viewpoints evolve and want to learn more. And I have this thirst for knowledge and the understanding of recovery and what works and what doesn't, and to present those with people. So, you know, I don't believe in the coincidence of that. As I said at the beginning of this, like it was just by happenstance. I saw a comment you made and I was like, this guy is good. Yeah. I definitely want to talk to him. And then, you know, we chatted online for a bit and I saw the stuff that you're doing and I've read aspects of your book and things that you've put out there. I was like, well, I have to have you on the show. And that way, you know, gives people a different way to look at this and maybe do some research and read this book and say, look, these things can be changed, and at least entertain the idea that maybe there's something else to this and that this can be learned just as much as, and you've laid out so eloquently, much better than I could, how that would be done. And then lastly, just saying that, you know, anybody can have this life of addiction, this life of recovery. Anybody can have an addiction too, but the life of recovery part. So thank you once again. What I'm going to do is just, you know, to everybody, check out Keith's book, The Infinite Recovery Handbook. It is out. And, you know, more than likely will change your life, especially if you're searching for answers on what to do with this. Keith, thank you very much. To my listeners, you guys are awesome. All the international people, which still blows me away. Number one in Finland, out of all places, I didn't even know they had, that they were listening. But you guys are awesome. As always, do big things.